Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Bring the world closer with podcasts from the BBC World Service. Unmissable stories from around the globe.
Whoa.
Search for The Documentary, Lives Less Ordinary, and Amazing Sports Stories, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You better be ready, because we're going to bring it to you.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 31st of December, these are our main stories. After a massive aerial attack on Ukraine, Russia now suffers a retaliatory bombardment with reports of 18 dead.
It's the most concentrated number of Russian deaths we've seen in these strikes, and Ukraine is saying it launched more than 70 drones.
Israel's prime minister has warned that the war in Gaza could go on for many more months as his military extends its offensive in the south. And there's division in Switzerland about whether to cull wolves.
The safety issue of the wolf has been greatly exaggerated, and the truth is that there hasn't been a single death or even a single instance of an aggressive wolf in Switzerland since the 1990s when they returned.
Also in this podcast, a female champion wrestler has returned her medals to highlight sexual harassment of other women athletes in India. And
it was only a few years ago that I didn't know anything about this world. Now I'm still amazed at what I can achieve.
The Briton who skied across Antarctica in what looks like record time. Let's start this podcast in Russia, which has been hit by one of the biggest waves of aerial attacks since it started the war in Ukraine. It comes just a day after Russia's bombardment of Ukraine. 18 people are reported dead in Belgorod, a city about 30 kilometres from the Ukrainian border in Russia's southwest, after it was struck by drones and missiles. Moscow has since retaliated by striking at central Kharkiv. Officials said 20 people were injured there, including an unnamed British journalist. For the latest, from Kyiv, Ben James heard from James Waterhouse.
Usually, Kyiv is a little bit coy when it comes to officially admitting responsibilities for drone attacks like this into Russian territory. We've seen it before in that Belgorod region, as well as towards Moscow itself. But this time around, it was a definitive yes, this is in response to the unprecedented aerial bombardment that Ukraine endured yesterday when Russia launched more than 150 missiles, killing 39 people and injuring many more. In terms of what we're seeing in Belgorod and the nearby city of Bryansk inside Russia, it's the most concentrated number of Russian deaths we've seen in these strikes. And Ukraine is saying it launched more than 70 drones. So that gives you an idea of how it was keen to apply this response. It's saying that they were targeting military sites, but the collateral damage here in that civilians appear to have lost their lives too, according to Russian officials. Clearly, that was a collateral damage they were willing to accept. But there's also a psychological element here as well, where if you're Ukraine, if you start targeting neighbouring Russian towns and cities and people start seeing blown out windows, destroyed cars like they've seen today, it's harder for them to ignore Russia's continued invasion of its western neighbour.
And tonight we're hearing about more strikes on Ukraine in Kharkiv. Is that a continuation, it seems, of this exchange over the past few days?
Yeah, it's a bit of a strange one, really. Kharkiv is a place we were staying at until about 3 days ago, and the Kharkiv Palace Hotel was where we were, and it's been directly hit. And so there's a lot of damage, and you wonder how the staff are doing there. And we were told by officials that a number of sites in the city, including a medical facility and residential blocks, have been hit. And the Kremlin vowed, in its words, that the actions of Ukraine wouldn't go unpunished. And it seems it's not waiting around. I mean, Kharkiv endures missile strikes frequently. Just to give you an idea, yesterday, more than 20 missiles were fired at it. And so it feels like, alongside the fighting we see on the front lines, this kind of aerial bombardment that we're seeing, Ukraine's ability to respond in kind, we're seeing a real escalation in both sides trying to target civilian areas. But we have to apply the context here that it is Ukraine that weathered these strikes far more frequently on a much greater scale than it is Russia.
James Waterhouse reporting from Kyiv. Now, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that the war in Gaza will continue for many more months to come. In a defiant TV address, he vowed to eliminate Hamas and bring the remaining hostages home. He spoke of a complex operation, but said Israel had the upper hand.
The war is in full swing. We are fighting on all fronts. We have great successes, but we also have painful prices. Achieving victory requires more time. My policy is very clear. We are going to continue fighting until we've achieved all the objectives of this war.
His comments on Saturday night come as Israeli tanks pushed deeper into parts of central and southern Gaza. In the city of Khan Yunis, the Israeli army says it's recovered what it claimed was very valuable intelligence material from Hamas sites. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yoland Nell.
Street battles between Israeli soldiers and Hamas fighters have been intense in Khan Yunis, seen as a stronghold of the armed group in southern Gaza. And Israeli warplanes have continued to strike the urban refugee camps in the centre of the territory, ahead of a further advance by ground troops. Overwhelmed hospitals are still struggling to treat the wounded. While Israel says it's not limiting aid allowed into Gaza, the UN has complained that the amount getting through remains woefully inadequate. Thomas White, the Gaza director of UNRWA, told me about the challenges.
It's very difficult to get aid into Gaza. It's a very long and convoluted process. And then once the aid's in Gaza, you know, it's very difficult to get aid to people. Essentially, we're delivering aid under fire.
Along the border with Egypt, Palestinian families set up makeshift tents. Aerial footage shows a sprawling, crowded campsite. Tens of thousands of Gazans have fled the ongoing fighting, heading towards Rafah in recent days. With the vast majority of people in Gaza now displaced from their homes, UN health officials say they're seeing a rise in the spread of infectious diseases.
Well, that was Yoland Nell reporting from Jerusalem. In Nicaragua, the country's president, Daniel Ortega, has overseen a further crackdown on the Catholic Church. In the past few days, priests critical of his long-serving left-wing government have reportedly been taken from their homes and arrested. Ever since mass protest was ignited across the country in 2018, relations between Ortega and the Catholic Church have become strained. Our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha, explained more.
The information is very scarce. It's coming from the opposition and from church sources, people who are basically outside Nicaragua, because the main newspaper there, La Prensa, they had to leave the country and they're now operating from Costa Rica. So what we know is that seven people have been arrested overnight, priests, not only in the capital, Managua, but in other locations as well. If you go back about a week from the 20th, you have about 12 to 14 priests and people linked to the Catholic Church in Nicaragua who have been arrested.
Just tell us a bit about why the relationship between the Catholic Church and Ortega's government has deteriorated so much over the last, what, 4 or 5 years?
To start with, Daniel Ortega is a former Marxist rebel, so his relations with the church were never ideal. But he, for many years, he's been in power since 2007, will be 17 years now in January. So his relationship with the church was okay for a long time. Out of the blue, you had protests in 2018. You had mass street protests, started for some other reason, and took the government totally by surprise. And their response was very forceful. More than 300 people, most of them young opposition activists, were killed. So what the church did is then the Catholic Church and Catholic priests, they came out and they denounced a violation of human rights. They tried to protect those people. And the government then accused them of being part of a plot led by the United States to oust his government. So that's when the relationship deteriorated from in the past 4 or 5 years.
So given his political leanings, I mean, this is like what we saw in Poland 45 years ago, or what we see in China now, where I used to live. It's a kind of a fear or a deep scepticism of organized religion because they believe it poses a threat.
Yes, and with the Catholic Church, what happened in Poland as well, there's a dual allegiance. You know, people are Nicaraguans, but they also obey or respect what the church, what the Vatican are saying. So there's a power that comes from the outside. What people believe that's been happening now, this latest crackdown on the church, is that earlier this year in February, more than 200 people were exiled from Nicaragua as part of a deal. including 12 priests, and one of them, a bishop, Rolando Alvarez, refused to go in the last minute. And about a month later or 2 months later, he was sentenced to 26 years in prison. And he became sort of a martyr. And the Pope has been talking about them. So what is believed is that all those priests have been mentioning him in sermons in church. Let's pray for Rolando Alvarez. And anyone that mentioned him was then arrested.
Leonardo Rocha with the latest on Nicaragua and the Catholic Church. Wolf numbers have been rising in Europe for more than 50 years now, so much so that in some places, like Switzerland, they cull the animals to control the population. But a court there has been asked to intervene and decide if the wolves roaming its mountains are dangerous predators that need driving out or a precious part of a delicate ecosystem. Imogen Folks has more.
The wolf definitely has a place. It's a builder of ecosystems. Switzerland is big enough for between 55 and 100 packs.
I'm with environmental campaigner Lucy Wutrich, out enjoying the Swiss landscape. The views are spectacular. Green pastures, thick forests, the Alps rising in the distance. Switzerland is also a densely populated country. But Lucy's been telling me we've got nothing to fear from wolves.
The safety issue of the wolf has been greatly exaggerated, and the truth is that there hasn't been a single death or even a single instance of an aggressive wolf in Switzerland since the 1990s when they returned. So all this is nonsense.
But Lucy's talking about danger to people. Sheep, on the other hand, do need to be worried. Just last week, a few miles from here, a wolf attacked and killed 11 of them. Sandro Michael explains why the Farmers Association backed the wolf cull.
The main problem is in high alpine farming. Every morning the farmers are finding dead sheep. We've tried sheepdogs, fences, shepherds. 90% of farms have these, but the sheep keep getting attacked. We've got night cameras that have recorded wolves jumping over the fences back and forth, minute by minute.
To the farmers' disappointment, the cull, which would have allowed the complete elimination of a number of Switzerland's 32 wolf packs, has been suspended. Lucy says the stay of execution is good for the environment.
Wolves, by predating on certain animals, they create habitats for others. They also prevent the damage to forests. We have too many deer that are eating and destroying young trees. And in certain forests in Switzerland, the deer are responsible for actually changing the species composition of forests. So wolves are very much part of Switzerland, and we ought to welcome them back.
But now the European Union, under pressure like Switzerland from its farmers, is also planning to control rising wolf numbers. Toby Aykroyd of Wild Europe, a group which promotes the restoration of wilderness areas, argues the farming lobby's power far outweighs its economic benefits.
It reflects an increasingly outdated view of the relatively proportionate importance of the various sectors of the economy, if you like, never mind the ecological situation. If you take Switzerland, agriculture as a whole provides about 0.6% of gross domestic product. And upland grazing, which is the subset that we're talking about, is much, much lower still.
But that, says Sandro Michael, is an opinion Swiss farmers find worrying and deeply insulting to their alpine traditions.
If you really think like that, you have to ask if these people even want our mountain farmers. We need a compromise. As farmers, we don't want to eradicate wolves in Switzerland or Europe, but we need to regulate them. Otherwise, coexistence between livestock and wolf in a farming country like Switzerland, I don't see it.
Peaceful coexistence between humans and animals is at the heart of this debate. Everyone seems to want it, but no one really agrees on how many wolves are too many.
Imogen Folks reporting. Now, recognise this sound? Well, there will be lots of corks, yes, that was a cork, popping to celebrate the onset of 2024. But when the parties are over, for some, those New Year's resolutions begin, and that can mean putting away alcohol for a month. Dry January has become an increasingly popular phenomenon here in the UK and other countries, but not so in France. With all its world-class wines and champagne, the French have a reputation for being refined drinkers. But 45 academics and doctors have signed a letter urging the French government to promote an official period of abstention from alcohol. My colleague Caroline Wyatt asked the French journalist Anna-Elisabeth Moutet whether the no-drinking challenge is likely to catch on in France, like it has here.
I've not heard it so much. I mean, it has not made the kind of a splash that Dry January, which is a thing in Britain, has. We've never had licensing hours in France, and the one thing you could find, even at times of rationing tickets just after the war, was still wine. I remember when I was operated in the 80s that grown-ups had wine at hospital on their hospital platter that came, you know, when people were given food.
Is there, though, more of le binge drinking, as it was known, in France these days?
There is more binge drinking in France than there used to be. You don't have the sights that you do have in Britain on Saturday nights, which are sort of pretty amazing, but it started a bit.
France is the second biggest consumer of wine in the world, so presumably French politicians still listen pretty closely to the country's wine industry. It's a big, big employer of something like 500,000 people.
It is a big employer, and there's more than that. It is absolutely part of the culture. And some of the French wines that are being produced, as you know, are so expensive that most French people can't afford them anymore because they're so prized. And then there's a secondary industry of good average wine, and that is better than in most places, and it's affordable. There's also all sorts of new winemakers, and they do bio-cyclical wines, and they do green wines. So there's a whole culture of this being something like an art, just as the French lunch has become one listed as part of the intangible cultural heritage of France by UNESCO. Wine is definitely part of the French cultural heritage. We see it like that.
Where does President Macron stand on all this?
Well, he drinks, which is a big difference with his predecessor, Nicolas Sarkozy, who was a teetotaler because he didn't like the taste, and François Hollande, who was not very big on wine. And he has one or two glasses of wine at lunch and dinner, and he says a meal without wine is really a bit sad. So he is, for many reasons, including, of course, all the wonderful tax income that comes from selling wine, he's more in favour of wine. But I also think that he sees the cultural part of it.
Well, that was the French journalist Anne-Elisabeth Moutet. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
One that I do love playing, mainly because its message of positivity, is Joe Smooth's epic Promised Land. Brothers,
sisters. We have top tips for tunes to dance your way into 2024 from a famous club DJ. Welcome back to the Global News podcast. Now, people in the Sudanese city of Niala have taken to the streets to denounce bomb attacks allegedly perpetrated by the Sudanese army. Some reports suggest more than 100 civilians were either killed or badly wounded in Friday's barrel bomb attacks on the capital of South Darfur state. The airstrikes are said to have targeted positions of the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. Our Africa editor Richard Hamilton has more.
Witnesses said the airstrikes caused widespread destruction, leaving dozens of homes razed to the ground and forcing thousands to flee for their safety. The latest airstrike comes just weeks after the Sudanese Air Force is alleged to have targeted the army headquarters in Niala, which has been under the control of the Rapid Support Forces since October. A local human rights group, Darfur Justice Platform, condemned the attacks on populated areas, describing them as war crimes. The RSF called them tragic and heinous. The army has not yet commented on the accusations.
Richard Hamilton. Now, let's go to India, where one of the country's top female wrestlers, Vinesh Pogat, has returned two sports awards given by the government because she wants to highlight alleged sexual harassment of female athletes. She and several wrestlers accused the former president of the Indian Wrestling Federation, Brij Bhushan Sharan Singh, of sexual harassment. He denies the charges. From Delhi, here's our South Asia correspondent, Ambarasan Etiraja.
In a symbolic move, Vinesh Pogat, a world championship medalist, left the two prestigious awards by the roadside curb in the Indian capital after she was refused permission to meet Prime Minister Narendra Modi. She said such honours had become meaningless at a time when wrestlers were struggling to get justice. Pogat and several other female athletes accuse Brijbhushan Sharan Singh, an influential MP from the governing BJP, of sexual harassment. He has denied the allegations. A court is hearing sexual harassment and criminal intimidation charges against Mr. Singh. A close associate of Mr. Singh was chosen as the new president of the federation earlier this month, triggering angry protests by the wrestlers. Another prominent female wrestler, Sakshi Malik, said she was quitting the sport in protest at the election of Mr. Singh's loyalist. The Indian Sports Ministry has suspended the newly elected governing body of the Wrestling Federation, accusing it of ignoring rules by hastily announcing junior championships.
Ambarasan Etirajan reporting. Now, China has expelled 9 senior military officers from its parliament, the National People's Congress. They include 4 generals of the Army's Strategic Missile Force, where there have been reports of a corruption investigation within the military. My colleague Rachel Wright asked our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton, why they were kicked out.
Well, we don't have any official reason, hasn't been given. But as you just said, there's been swirling rumours for quite some time of an anti-corruption investigation that's coursing through the military. Now, the key thing is that these army officials, now that they've been dropped from parliament, they've now lost their immunity from legal prosecution. And all of this, Rachel, really relates back to August, when China's then defense minister disappeared from public view, had to cancel a number of high-profile summits because he wasn't able to attend. Then in October, we found out that this man, Li Shangfu, had simply been dropped from his post of defense minister, one of China's top positions, and we got no explanation. Now, the rumors that have been swirling around is that this all relates back to Li Shangfu's time when he was in charge of procuring military equipment for China's military, a really important post. And it's thought that maybe there were some corrupt deals relating to that that have taken him out of his post and have taken a number of military officials out of their posts, including the 9 today. So we're all just kind of waiting to see how this will stem down. But this is just the latest batch of officials that seem to have been abruptly removed from their posts without any real explanation.
You mentioned the defense minister, and other ministers have also gone missing.
Yeah, that's right. So China's foreign minister was also removed from his post without explanation earlier this year. Qin Gang was thought to be a key ally of China's leader, Xi Jinping, just like Li Shangfu. The two of them, actually, the former defense minister and former foreign minister, were both allies of the top leader. They both disappeared from view. So the foreign minister also disappeared without explanation. It was then sort of abruptly announced that he wouldn't be returning to his post and he was replaced. So we have two men who really were very close to Xi Jinping who are now gone. And that really leaves Xi Jinping looking a little bit lonely because he's really risen up through the ranks by ejecting his rivals from power, but also by promoting his allies. And these are two men who we thought would probably stay in their post for quite some time, who are now just gone.
Celia Hatton reporting. Cast your mind back to 32 days ago. What were you doing? Well, Preet Chandy was starting out on a mission to ski alone across Antarctica, and it looks like she's done it in record time. She battled temperatures of minus 30 degrees Celsius and journeyed through severe snowstorms to get there. After reaching the South Pole, she posted this reaction on her social media.
I honestly didn't know if I would be quick enough, but thought I'll do everything I can and we'll see. This was a solo expedition, but there are so many people that have helped me get here. It was only a few years ago that I didn't know anything about this world. Now I'm still amazed at what I can achieve.
There is a bit of an important caveat on this, though. Before Chandy can claim the title, the Guinness World Records must verify it, a process which could take several months. Well, the newsroom's Madeleine Drury talked me through her achievement.
Well, I don't know what you were up to at 2:30 in the morning, UK time on Thursday, Robin, but that's when Preet Chandy claims that she reached the South Pole after covering 1,130 kilometres on her skis. So from my rough calculations, that's a bit like walking from Amsterdam in the Netherlands to Toulouse in the south of France. She says it took her 31 days, 13 hours and 19 minutes, and I expect those vital minutes are what the Guinness World Record team, as you say, will be verifying over the the coming weeks. The previous record holder for the fastest unsupported female expedition was a Canadian woman called Caroline Cote. And if Preet's record gets the thumbs up from the Guinness World Record team, then Preet has beaten Caroline's record by 1 day, 14 hours and 34 minutes.
Now, we are sitting here in a relatively warm studio talking about skiing for 31 days on the Antarctic. I mean, just tell us a bit about how she actually did it.
She set off alone back in late November from the Hercules Inlet, which is a popular starting point for many people attempting their adventures on the continent. So just picture this. The sun is beating down, this endless vista of white in front of Preet, and she's carrying a 75-kilogram sled with all of her kit alone. That's everything she needed to survive, including freeze-dried food, perhaps a bit of chocolate and fruit in there to keep her going as well. And on average, she says she was skiing for 12 to 13 hours a day. In her day job, she's a British Army medical officer and has previously broken two world records for another polar expedition. So she's good at what she does. The records she'd broken there were for the longest polar ski journey by a woman and the overall record for the same journey. Despite these adventures in Antarctica that she's already had, she says she's just feeling like she's dipping her toes in an ocean and expects someone could come along in time and potentially break her own record. And she's happy to help them with that when they do.
Madeline Drury, and I'm just going to give you a few seconds to think about that. Skiing for 12 or 13 hours a day on your own across Antarctica. OK, finally, what are you going to do to celebrate the new year? Perhaps you're planning to go out for the evening, or maybe you're staying in, invite some friends round, have a bit of a do. Well, who better to suggest some music to see in 2024 than Graham Park, the former resident DJ at Manchester's iconic Hacienda nightclub. Now, I've been told to say this next bit by the producer of this podcast, who spent many a night partying there back in the 1980s, apparently. Well, Graham Park has been going through his recommended playlist with my colleague, Caroline Wyatt.
I find that because it's New Year's Eve, because everyone's ready to party, to say goodbye to the year and welcome in the new year, I always go for something absolutely massive that's going to bring a massive smile to everyone's face while they all hug each other and think of people who can't celebrate New Year's Eve. So I would always go big.
What are the obvious ones?
Alison Limerick, Where Love Lives, or a Robin S, Show Me Love. They always work really well. But one that I do love playing, mainly because it's message of positivity, is Joe Smooth's epic Promised Land. Brothers, sisters, one day we will be free from fighting, violence, people crying in the street. I think that would be my number one choice. As someone who's been doing this every weekend since the early 80s, I personally love mixing up the old and the new. And, you know, new generations of clubbers love to hear old records where they can imagine what it was like.
What do you do about the clock striking midnight? Do you have the bongs?
I do have the bongs. Back in the day, it would be a BBC Sound Effects Workshop record. I'm looking at my watch. I know exactly what time to press play on Big Ben so that the first bong is exactly on midnight. I'm sounding very geeky here, but I love it. First word of the first vocal will start right after the first bong, and everybody goes absolutely mental.
What about to end the evening? What would you play as your last one?
If you have the opportunity of playing one more tune, then you've got to decide whether to take it down or ramp it up. So
I quite often will drop my brand new heavies, Back to Love, remix. The a cappella of my remix ends with the vocals repeating, brother's going to need it, sister says you need it, we're all going to need it one day. We seem to lose our way, somehow get led astray. That's why I'm here to say, gotta get back to it now.
I know you need it, brother said you need it, sister said she needs it. We are gonna need it someday, we seem to lose our way, somehow got led astray. That's why I'm here to say, gotta get back to it now.
Graham Park's New Year's Eve playlist, ending our last episode of the Global News Podcast for 2023. Well, that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition, of course, of the Global News Podcast at the same time tomorrow. Now, as we head towards the new year, we want to hear about stories which are important to you and that maybe can feature on the podcast in 2024. If you have something you think others would be interested in and the BBC could report on, then send us an email with the details. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Jack Graysmark, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt, and on behalf of the entire Global News Podcast team, Happy New Year. We hope that 2023 was good for you. If not, here's to 24. Goodbye.